Lean Than Mithrik, moved up to join them. Kalir, the youngest member of the team, having completed her trials and achieved Jedi Knight status only weeks before, wore an abbreviated dress in white that contrasted nicely with her tan fur and would not overheat her on this warm day. Than, dressed in a traveler's robe, looked the most Jedi-like of the four of them, but was still thoroughly unremarkable of appearance in this cosmopolitan city. He had his hood up over his long black topknot and was maintaining his skin color at a light orange, making him virtually indistinguishable from a human.
"I don't see any problems," Kalir said.
Not that reassuring, coming from someone who'd been an apprentice a few days ago, Jaina reflected. She heard Zek snicker. Kalir looked curiously at him, but Jaina said, "Transmit that we're on station."
Outer space, near the Corellian system.
Luke, dressed in what looked like standard brown and tan Jedi gear, but which actually had all the equipment and functionality of a pilot suit, sat on the rolling staircase that was meant to give a pilot or mechanic access to the X-Wing's top surfaces. It wouldn't be needed for that purpose. The mechanics were finished for now with his XJ-6 X-Wing, and Luke wouldn't need any assistance in getting to the cockpit. For a Jedi, it was just one quick leap away. The bay where his squadron's X-Wings waited was frantic with activity. A broad expanse, all scuffed and burned permacrete flooring and pristine glow-white ceiling. It was the size of a sports arena, with room for Luke's squadron, a squad of E-5 interceptors, two squads of shield-equipped TIEs from the Imperial Remnant, and half a squad of B-Wings for support. One X-Wing over, Mara, similarly garbed, made some final ratcheting motions with her hydro spanner, finishing adjustments to her laser cannon positioning, and slapped closed an access panel on her craft's S-foil underside. She dropped the hydro spanner in a toolbox and moved over to join her husband. "Any word about Ben?" Luke shook his head. "You're very quiet." Mara leaned over to stroke his forehead. "Is everything all right?" "I meditated earlier," he said, "and I had a vision of Ben talking to the man who doesn't exist." "Not a dream," Mara said. "A vision." He nodded. "Could you tell when?" "The future." Ben was a little older, a little taller. "At least," she said, "that argues well for what he's up to today."
"Master Skywalker."
The voice, female, emerged from the vicinity of Luke's chest. He reached under his robe and pulled out a comlink. "Skywalker here."
"Bridge here. Team Perella reports on station."
"Thank you." He put the comlink away. "Jaina is ready, and that's one more check on the checklist to start this operation." Luke glanced around the pilots of his squadron. Some were talking with one another. Three were stretched out in the shadows of their X-Wings, sleeping. Two sat cross-legged, meditating. He nodded in approval at this calmness in the eye of the storm.
"Master Skywalker, Team Minock reports in position."
Luke almost sagged with relief. The lack of any sort of complications notification meant that Ben, Jason, and Dr. Sayah were aboard Centerpoint Station and standing by. Then over the hangar speakers came a different voice, male, that of Dodonna's flight control officer.
"All pilots to their craft. Group enters hyperspace in 5 minutes. All pilots to their craft."
Luke looked around at his pilots. "Hardpoint squadron, mount up."
Coronet, Corellia.
Kalir gestured down the avenue, then glanced at the chrono embedded at the snap closure of her bag.
"Right on time," she said.
The other Jedi turned to look. In the middle distance, approaching at a high rate of speed, even for Corellian drivers, was a convoy of closed canopy airspeeders. The two in front and two in back were Corsec vehicles painted in brown and burnt orange, and warning lights of the same color flashed atop their forward viewports. The middle vehicle was a somber crimson, its viewports tinted to prevent those outside from viewing whoever might be inside. "Jedi," Jaina said, "meet Idel Saxon, Prime Minister of the Five Worlds. Idel, meet your captors." The convoy, floating in from above the fluid streams of groundspeeder traffic, merged with the incoming stream and slowed to the groundspeeder travel rate as it neared the Jedi.
"Just like we practiced it," Jaina said. "Three, two, one, now."
In unison, the four Jedi leapt up and over the cross traffic, each arcing toward one of the speeders in the convoy. Jaina whipped off her traveler's robe as she leapt, leaving her dressed in a close-fitting black jumpsuit. Her lightsaber was at her belt when the rogue flew away, in her hand before she cleared the lane of cross-traffic ground speeders, and lit as she came down on the forward portion of the lead Corsac vehicle. She plunged its glowing blade into the metal surface beneath her and wrenched it around, cutting through the vehicle's engine compartment. There was a pop, and the speeder immediately began to lose speed and altitude. All four Corsac speeders were now shrilling an alarm, a high-pitched, rapid-pulse tone that hammered Jaina's ears and told Corellians for a kilometer around that there was trouble. Jaina felt the blow as the speeder she rode hit the avenue, but the pilot was good, retaining control. The speeder bumped once, hard, slewed to port, slewed to starboard, and came to a skidding shower of sparks stop not far from the Prime Minister's residence gates. Then she felt the pulse of shock and alarm from Zek. Zek came down atop the Prime Minister's speeder and drove his lightsaber into the canopy over the passenger compartment. It was a shallow thrust, followed by the traditional circular swirl, and it was a slow maneuver. The airspeeder was heavily armored, and from the instant Zek landed, it began a series of swerves and climb-and-dive bucking maneuvers, all designed to throw him free. He just grinned, relying on the Force to keep him rooted firmly in place. The airspeeder was upside down and 50 meters above the avenue when Zek finished transcribing his circle with the lightsaber. The impromptu hatch he'd cut fell past him. He leaned upward, the awkward position and angle pulling muscles like an abdomen-firming exercise, and stuck his head into the passenger compartment to confront his quarry. "Madam Minister," he said, He wasn't looking at the Five-World Prime Minister. The only individuals in the passenger compartment were droids. A skeletal figure with a Corsac uniform loosely fitted to it was in the forward position, piloting. And in the spacious crimson velour-lined main compartment sat a battered old protocol droid wearing a cumbersome ball gown and matching wide-brimmed hat of blue velvet. It held a rectangular object that looked like a double-thick portable computer terminal in closed position. On the top surface was a blinking red light.
"I have been instructed to play this for any unexpected visitors."
Then it pressed the button. Zek straightened, yanking his head and shoulders free of the hole, and leapt clear, straight down. He was a bare 2 meters from the inverted airspeeder when it exploded. Kaleer and Van, riding their respective crippled Corsac vehicles to shuddery sliding stops on the avenue, heard the boom and looked up. The reddish flash of the explosion was enough to blind Than for a moment. He threw his free arm over his eyes and concentrated on maintaining his balance. Kaleer didn't look at the explosion straight on. She saw chunks of disintegrated airspeeder flying out of the explosion cloud, and to the lower left, Zek, limp, on fire, plummeting. She raised her hand, an instinctive gesture, and exerted herself through the motion, feeling the Force swell from her, feeling it intermix with the unique set of sensations and memories and textures that were Zek. She focused entirely on the task at hand, abandoning the attention she had been paying to the Force-based adhesion that kept her feet firmly planted on the slewing, skidding airspeeder beneath them, on the lit lightsaber in her hand, or on the honking, beeping, screeching groundspeeder traffic roaring toward her and veering aside at the last second. She found Zek and slowed his descent. Now he was 15 meters above the pavement outside the Prime Minister's residence. His back was still on fire, and smoke curled up from his shoulders. Then Kaleer's airspeeder hit the rear of Jaina's downed airspeeder. Kaleer catapulted forward, smashed into the rear of that vehicle's passenger compartment, ricocheted off at an angle, hit the pavement of the avenue itself, and rolled a dozen meters before coming to a halt, bloody and unconscious. Jaina's eyes cleared from the explosion afterimage in time for her to see Zek suspended in the air not far from her, and Zek suddenly plummeting again. She leapt free of her airspeeder, hurtling between oncoming speeders in the next lane, and landed on the sidewalk outside the residence. Drawing on the Force with more speed and confidence than Kaleer could have ever employed, she caught Zek 5 meters off the ground, lowering him quickly but safely to the walk beside her. She slapped at the flames dancing across his back, smothering them. Through the Force, she could feel life pulsing strongly within him. The doors of the airspeeder she'd ridden in down whooshed open, and its two passengers stepped out. They weren't Corsac agents. They were tall and angular, their skins gleaming and metallic. Brandishing oversized blaster rifles, they advanced on Jaina's position with a confidence born of aggression programming and a lack of concern for their own welfare. They were YVH droids, Yuuzhan Vong Hunters, produced by Tendrando Arms during the Yuuzhan Vong War, designed to match those fearsome alien warriors in deadliness and determination. "We," Jaina said, "are in trouble."
Outer Space Carrier Dodona.
Lysa Dunter sat cursing her bangs and waiting for launch. A pretty blue-eyed young woman with dark blonde hair, she never lacked for attention, but got slightly more when she kept her hair in a shortcut with bangs. But if she didn't sweep her hair back absolutely correctly in the split second before donning her flight helmet, her bangs would drift down again and hover at the top of her peripheral vision, as they did now. She could take her helmet off in a cramped Eta-5 interceptor cockpit and try to adjust things, but if her squadron commander, whose interceptor rested on the Dodona starfighter hangar floor one row up and just to the left of hers, were to see her do it, he'd mock her. Lysa didn't like being mocked. Her speakers popped. Then she heard her squadron commander.
V-Sword lead to pilots. Report status.
The commander's wingwoman immediately replied.
V-Sword 2, tip-top, ready to go.
Lysa's breathing grew faster. They were right on the verge of it. Her first combat launch. She heard the pilot before her in sequence complete his acknowledgement.
V-7.
Lysa said when it was her turn. 2 green, weapons lit. Moments later, once the last of the 10 pilots had reported in, the squad leader said,
V-Sword 7, we're hearing a strange vibration over your comm.
Guiltily, Lysa froze her right leg in place, willing it to keep from bouncing.
Sorry, sir, she said. Had to dog down a loose rocker arm.
You sure it wasn't a rocker leg, 7?
The squad leader's voice sounded amused. Lysa closed her eyes and bit back a curse. Then a new voice.
Hyperspace jump complete. All squadrons, prepare to launch. Hardpoint squadron. Shuttle Trandrilla Skies, first in queue.
Straight ahead of Lysa's position, but obscured by the ranks of Eta-5 interceptors ahead of her and X-Wings ahead of them, a dark line appeared in the floor, then broadened into a yawning starfield. Lysa saw the X-Wings complete their power-up procedures, some of them activating repulsors and floating up a meter or two off the hangar floor. She felt a stab of irritation that the Jedi Squadron would be the first flyers off Dodona in this operation, but she forced it back. The burners of the Jedi X-Wings kicked in, and they launched forward, diving down into a starry black gap leading to space. A squat armored shuttle lumbered along in their wake.
Vibro Sword Squadron, launch!
On the bridge of Dodona, Admiral Klauskin stood near the bow viewports, taking in the view and trying to reconcile it with words his aide spoke to him. To starboard hung the world of Corellia, close by. They'd winked in and out of hyperspace on the night side, close enough that the planet blocked out the sun. The ships belonging to the operation had arrived pointed straight down at the planet and had executed a simultaneous maneuver to port, swinging into high orbit and hurtling toward the planet's sunlit side. To port cruised the dozens of capital craft belonging to his operation. Cruisers, carriers, destroyers, frigates, and streaming from them were hundreds of starfighters and support vehicles. Every one of them cruised with running lights ablaze. Down on Corellia, all eyes would be attracted to the gleaming beauty of the GA military, to the flowing formation whose very presence said, "Do not defy the most powerful authority in the galaxy." Klauskin tuned back into the words of his aide, Fiav Fenn, a female Sullustan. She was saying something about the accuracy of their arrival pattern, which had apparently been pleasingly within the parameters he had set down in the previous day's staff meeting. He gently shook his head and waved to brush the topic aside.
"Ground response?" he asked.
She paused as if to change gears.
"None so far."
"None?"
Klauskin frowned.
"How long since we dropped out of hyperspace?"
4 minutes, 38 seconds, she said. 39, 40, 41...
"Yes, yes,"
Klauskin blinked. The Corellian armed forces must be very sloppy not to have their first fighter squadrons off the ground after more than 4.5 minutes. Then, the other fleet winked into existence. He saw the flicker of green running lights in his left side peripheral vision, even as the bridge's threat alarms began howling. The Admiral spun to look and stood there, transfixed. Stretched thin as a veil, a formation of spacecraft now occupied space between Klauskin's formation and every reasonable exit path away from Corellia. It was on the same course as Klauskin's fleet. A higher orbit, its vehicles and vessels traveling much faster than Klauskin's in order to maintain the same relationship to the world below, and Klauskin's fleet in between. Klauskin finally regained control of his voice.
"Kill the alarms,"
he said, his voice to his own ears sounding weak.
"We already know they're here. Composition?"
"Working on it," his chief sensor operator said. They have nothing in the size class of Dodona, but they have Strident-class star defenders and a large number of frigates, corvettes, patrol boats, gunships, and heavy transports. Mostly Corellian Engineering Corporation, of course. They must have lifted every half-finished frame, every rusted hulk, and every pleasure boat in the system to have pulled this off.
Kloskin's unobtrusive aide, Fiov, decided to become more obtrusive, stepping up beside the Admiral.
Sir,
she whispered,
have you revised orders for the operation?
Revised orders?
Kloskin's mind went oddly blank as he considered that question. It was an unsettling feeling, especially in one for whom decisiveness had always been a career hallmark. Ah, that was the problem. Revised orders should be issued to enable his formation to accomplish its goals, despite the complication that the Corellian formation posed. But that was now impossible. The overriding goal of this operation was to use a show of force to induce fear, awe, and consternation in the Corellians. But he could not do that now. He had failed. Less than 5 minutes into his operation, he had failed. His thinking processes became attached to that notion and could not pull free of it.
Centerpoint Station, Corellian System.
Jason brushed aside the cloth over his head and peered out. Out, up, back. The conveyance he lay upon was one open-topped car of a repulsor train. The cars, connected end-to-end, floated along a containment track laid years earlier along Centerpoint Station's long axis. Jason could tell from the way the ceiling was no longer kilometers away, but only hundreds of meters above, and getting closer, that they were heading out of the vast open central area, known as Hollowtown, and into a narrowing choke point toward the station's top. The region where the greatest number of significant control chambers had been found. The region where the majority of the investigating scientists' new installations of equipment and computer gear had been made. He lay alone in the midst of a mound of supplies for the station residents. Bolts of cloth, preserved foods, crates full of entertainment data cards, deactivated worker droids. Ben was also aboard the repulsor train, several cars back, maintaining his own hiding place. Jason had settled on this method of operation as the mission planning entered its final stages. "You'll trail me at a distance of not less than 50 meters," he had said. "Practice stealth techniques and make no effort to contact me unless your life is in danger. If I'm disabled, defeated, sucked through a malfunctioning atmosphere containment shield, or otherwise distracted from my goal, you set out on your own to accomplish it." The ceiling continued to get closer, until it was a mere 30 meters overhead. And then, Jason lurched as the repulsor train took a sharp turn and a plunging descent into a tunnel. The tunnel was three times the width necessary for the repulsor train, and lit by pastel green glow rods at intervals protruding from the walls every 100 meters or so were box-like metal extrusions. Someone had marked the metal extrusions with huge painted numbers. At the box extrusion marked 103, Jason swung aside the cloth concealing him, took a careful look around to make sure there were no observers present, and leapt free of his car. He landed beside the box extrusion and moved toward the nearest wall hatch, an access helpfully, if inelegantly, emphasized by splashes of orange paint. It was a depression in the wall, nearly oval but with more squared-off corners, about two-thirds the height of a human male. The hardened Durasteel door plugging it was of modern manufacture, as was the computer control panel mounted on the wall beside it. Jason tugged at the bar that indicated the hatch was dogged closed. Only the handle portion of the bar was accessible through an arc-shaped slot in the doorway, and pulling it from the left to the right position should have opened the hatch. The bar didn't budge. The hatch was locked. He ignited his lightsaber and drove it into the hatch toward the base. Half a minute later, the edges of the cut glowing gold from the lightsaber's heat, there was an audible thunk, and the metal bar swung free. Well above the area of overheated metal, Jason gave the hatch a push, and it swung open. Beyond was a cylindrical metal shaft, almost featureless, lit by green glow rods affixed at intervals. Dangling at head height were four heavy metal cables, ending in loops, and four lighter cables ending in small two-button controls, standard for industrial lifting and lowering. Jason put his lightsaber away, grabbed a loop with his left hand, and punched the lift button with his right. The winch controls at the top of the shaft activated and raised him with arm-jarring swiftness. Moments later, 40 meters up, the ride came to an end. A circular side tunnel led away from the shaft,
Jason gave himself the most fleeting push with the Force and swung over the floor of that tunnel, then dropped noiselessly. A few meters down, a ramp led up to another modern-era hatch. The dogging bar on this hatch was already in the right-hand position, and the control panel beside the hatch was not lit. Jason took his lightsaber in hand and pushed the hatch open. It required a little more push than its mass would ordinarily have called for. The atmospheric pressure on the other side of the hatch was higher than on Jason's side, and once he got the hatch more than a hand span open, cool air began to pour across him. Here, the only sounds were his own breathing and echoes from the air conditioning system. He could not see anything, but the chamber felt large, very large. Jason cleared his throat. He raised his voice so that it would carry. "Am I about to endure a speech?" Far overhead, banks of white light came on, dazzlingly bright. Jason shaded his eyes, focused his attention on the Force, on incoming danger, on malevolent intent. There was none. But a voice came from those walkways high on the other side of the chamber.
"Is this somebody's sense of humor, sending you?"
As Jason's vision cleared, he saw a man in deep blue civilian dress, boots, pants, roughly tunic, and open overcoat, and a dozen armored Corsec agents up on the balcony. That was Jason's route out of the chamber. Though Jason knew the man, he still felt a momentary shock of a different sort of recognition. For the man wore the face of Han Solo, but bearded, a little leaner, a little grayer, and possessed of a confidence that looked like political arrogance rather than Jason's father's cockiness.
"Thrakken Sal Solo," Jason said. "I thought you were spending all your time groundside on Corellia, telling the population what to think and pretending not to be a convicted felon."
"Little Jason," his father's near double gave him a condescending smile. "I'm also still in charge of restoring Centerpoint Station, and when word reached me that the GA intended to execute an offensive in Corellian space, an offensive that was premature by almost every political measurement, unless you factored in the possibility that they knew just how close I was to restoring the station to full operability, I decided I needed to be here to prepare against strike teams and commandos and Jedi."
Jason gave his cousin an admonishing look.
"You can never prepare against Jedi."
"Yes, you can. And I must admit to being offended. For a target as important as Centerpoint Station, shouldn't they have sent Luke Skywalker? Are you stronger than him?"
Jason offered a humorless smile.
"No, just educated in different directions. Would you and your troops do me a favor and get out of my way? There will be fewer severed limbs that way. Or heads."
Again, Thrakken offered him a pitying look.
"Jason, we can't afford to let you damage or destroy this station. It's not going to happen. Surrender now and you won't be killed. You won't even be hurt."
Thrakken, nonchalant, held a hand out to his side. One of the Corsec officers there handed him what looked like a flight helmet. With slow, deliberate motions, watching Jason all the time, Thrakken donned it. Then he snapped his fingers. Two droids, looking much like R5 astromechs, but with their top halves removed and replaced by naked machinery, rolled up from behind the Corsec officers to the rail. And the sound began. Jason didn't even experience it as sound at first. It hit him like a windstorm, blasting him to his knees, bringing pain to every millimeter of his skin as though he were being scorched by a gigantic blowtorch. His lightsaber fell from his lifeless fingers and rolled away. Even as the attack convulsed him with pain, Jason, in some dim portion of his mind that still functioned, recognized it. A sonic assault. Something that did not have to be aimed or tracked to bring a Jedi down.
Coronet Corellia.
Jaina stood over the injured and unconscious body of Zek, her lightsaber lit and in a ready position. Four YVH combat droids, situated behind crash Corsec airspeeders, poured near continuous blaster fire at her. She'd been able to deflect it all, mostly into the permacrete or back toward the firers, but none of her return shots had done them any significant damage. And the high intensity of their blasters and rapid rate of fire were tiring her. She needed just a second of rest to compose herself, to sweep the droids away, but they weren't giving her a second. Then a line of concentrated blue light leapt into existence behind the most distant of the combat droids. Jaina saw it flash around in an arc,
and the combat droid's head leapt from its shoulders with a shower of sparks. The other combat droids turned to look. Jaina took the opportunity to move forward, a little to the side, and could see Kaleer, the Bothan Jedi. Incongruous with her party girl dress, her lightsaber combat stance and the blood streaming from the right side of her mouth, kicked the droid's remains off its feet and turned to face the other three. Their blasters swung around, but Jaina had had her second of composure. She reached up and tugged at a large cargo drone, causing it to gain a few meters altitude, then to plummet, right onto two of the droids. It smashed down on them with the weight of tons of cargo. Jaina launched herself forward. She landed beside a permacrete crater that had been the last location she'd seen one of the combat droids. As she came down, she saw that it wasn't a crater. It was actually a hole, punched through into sewers or storm drains beneath. The YVH droid came leaping up through it, facing her. Jaina flashed her lightsaber across its midsection as it rose. She felt the considerable drag that the droid's combat armor caused even to a lightsaber blade. But the blade emerged from the other side, and the droid crashed to the pavement in two pieces. Jaina spared a glance back at Zek. He lay unmoving where she'd left him. Jaina turned to Kaleer. What's your status?
My teeth are loose on the right side.
With each word Kaleer spoke, more blood dribbled from her mouth and down her side. But she seemed unconcerned.
There's Than.
She pointed with her lightsaber. The Fallen Jedi was indeed headed their way, bouncing from speeder to speeder in the oncoming traffic lane like a hyperkinetic insect. Moments later, running at Jedi sprint speed, the Fallen warrior joined them at Zek's side. Jaina knelt beside Zek, put her hand on an unburned portion of his neck. He still felt strong. This operation is a bust, she said. And from the looks of things, the guards down by the gates are massing for a run at us. Let's deprive them of the opportunity to get themselves killed. Than, secure us some transportation.
Above Corellia.
Luke's hardpoint squadron made a high orbital crossing over to Corellia's dayside, and then a fast descent into the atmosphere. The squad's speed was hampered by its having to shepherd the shuttle Chandrilla Skies, and Yuulsho's space-capable light assault vehicle. Not much longer than an X-Wing, the LAV had a horizontal chisel-shaped bow and was much broader across the fuselage than a starfighter, giving it enough interior room to carry a dozen or so passengers, making it a good choice for the extraction of teams of Jedi now operating down in Coronet. A voice came across the comm.
Attention starfighter flight approaching Coronet from course 357. This is Corellian Defense Force headquarters in Coronet. You are classed as a hostile. Turn back or be fired upon.
On Luke's sensor board, squadrons of incoming craft were clearly visible, arriving from two different vectors. Ahead, he could see the near edge of the city of Coronet, and above it, the two units of incoming fighter craft that looked like Corellian attack fighters. He counted 18 of them on his sensor board, and that just wasn't enough to pose a serious threat to a squadron of 10 Jedi pilots. Then, the incoming squadrons turned aside, one to starboard and one to port, at right angles to Hardpoint Squadron's course. Luke felt a trickle of alarm. "Roll out!" he shouted, and followed his own orders. Snapping his X-Wing into a port roll, he was aware of Mara keeping close to him, just behind and to starboard. An explosion shook his snub fighter and rattled his teeth. R2-D2 howled, but immediately began putting up diagnostics on Luke's data screen. Luke ended his roll a quick kilometer lower than his original position. Explosions continued to batter at his eardrums, but nothing as close as the first one. He glanced between his sensor board and the skies above. The skies were filled with puffy gray clouds. They looked benign, but each was the lingering evidence of an explosion, results of a ground-based anti-spacecraft barrage. Luke counted 10 X-Wings still flying. He breathed a sigh of relief. Then his breath caught. There should be 11 craft. Chandrilla Skies? He asked.
Took a direct hit, Mara said. She's gone.
Three informed Odana of our situation, Luke told his communications specialist. See if they have updated orders to offer. Meanwhile, we're going in. If we can't get another shuttle, we'll bring our Jedi off Corellia if we have to land one by one and stuff them into our cargo hatches.
We have telemetry on CEC-1,
Fiob said to Kloskin, giving this operation's designation for the nearest of the Corellian Engineering Corporation's orbital shipyards. The course followed by Dodonna and the rest of her group would eventually bring her up on CEC-1.
It's protected by a large number of starfighters and a handful of frigates,
and there's the likelihood that as we approach, units from the main Corellian fleet will close.
Acknowledged,
Kloskin said.
Fiov paused, as if waiting for a more comprehensive response, then continued.
Corellian starfighter squadrons are crowding our squadrons. They're just jockeying around, but eventually somebody's going to cut loose with a laser shot, and it's going to be a fight.
Kloskin nodded briskly.
Understood.
Fiov paused again, then finally said,
Luke Skywalker reports that his squadron has been fired on, and that their shuttle has been lost. They request an additional shuttle, but he also says he'll extract his ground team individually in the X-Wings if he has to.
Ah, good. I'm glad he has a plan.
Kloskin felt his brain revving like an overturned thruster engine. Slowing the group to half speed would give him more time to decide, to think his way out of this dilemma. He needed the time. He thought and thought, but nothing seemed to happen. He had to turn the group towards space, batter his way through the Corellian screen if they decided to hinder his progress, and make it far enough out from Corellia's gravity well to activate hyperdrives. But that wasn't enough. He couldn't just run. He had to do something to salvage this mission. He had to intimidate or embarrass the Corellians, decisively. Somewhere. Somehow.
Coronet Corellia.
As the Jedi's commandeered groundspeeder hurtled along one of Coronet's main avenues in thinning traffic, a howl of distant space raid sirens filled the air, and tiny gray clouds began to pop up in the skies to the east, the direction of the groundspeeder's destination. Van handled the speeder yoke with one hand, keeping his comlink pressed up between ear and mouth with the other. Zek, stretched out on the back seat in Jaina's lap, had his eyes closed. He hadn't passed out. He had sunk into a short-term Jedi healing trance, one that would help him deal with the damage of the burns and shrapnel, so that his injuries would not hinder him as much when the time came for action. Van put his comlink away.
What's the situation?
Jaina shouted to him. Van pointed toward the distant gray anti-spacecraft clouds.
That's your Uncle Luke and the Jedi coming to take us off planet. But they've lost their shuttle, and he doesn't think they're getting another one.
Ah, Jaina said. Team Tauntaun was ambushed the way we were, except that they got inside Sal Solo's mansion. They were attacked by troops and probots.
Where are they now?
They're stealing a speeder and will rendezvous with us. They're thinking of stealing some payroll credit chips or kidnapping a holodrama star so we won't come back empty-handed.
Good of them. Anything else?
The fleet jumped in and was ambushed too. Nothing much is going right.
We need a spaceport, Jaina shouted. We'll have to steal a shuttle.
Center Point Station.
Jason rolled sideways, kicking the metal floor to propel himself, and managed to be a meter away when the first blaster bolt hit the spot where he'd been kneeling. He continued the roll, awkward because of the pain that racked him, but came up on his feet. Despite his blurring vision, he saw his lightsaber rolling across the floor, extended his hand toward it. Two white egg-shaped canisters hit the floor near him. He leapt backward away from them, rotating through the air as he went, and came down on his feet, but his legs buckled as he landed and crashed to the floor. He could still see his lightsaber. He exerted his will toward it. It wobbled on the floor and began rolling toward him. The egg-shaped canisters detonated, filling the air around them with white smoke. It rapidly spread, obscuring everything. But Jason managed to maintain his focus, and his lightsaber flew to his hand before the whiteness closed down all vision. Jason rolled to the side again, heard and felt the heat from blaster fire hitting where he'd just lain.
So they can see, he thought. Optics in their helmets. There had to be sound bafflers, too.
Well, he had a couple of tricks remaining, and they had nothing to do with specialized gear. He knew more about pain than his opponents realized. At the height of the Yuuzhan Vong War, he'd been a prisoner for months, subjected to their tortures and customs of self-inflicted agony. He had learned to function within their embrace of pain and other rituals that would break beings not accustomed to such hardships. A sudden infliction of pain could surprise him, surely, but it couldn't keep him down. He stood and moved forward. His first few steps were awkward and slow, his later ones sure, and once he was in full mastery of his body and the pain that suffused it, he put on a burst of speed in traditional Jedi fashion, outracing the blaster bolts that tailed him. Pain-racked, unslowed, he neared the wall and leapt high up on it, landing on one of the ascending ramps. Now he was still within the smoke cloud from the canisters, but shielded from the blast fire from above. Moments later, he reached the walkway level where Thrakken Sal Solo had stood. He still could not see, but through the Force he could detect living beings ahead of him. They were changing their order, some retreating, some advancing, the foremost of them aiming. The blaster bolts came, illuminating the canister smoke in curiously beautiful lines as they flashed toward him. He batted them back the way they'd come, mercilessly picking off the soldiers who'd fired them. Then he changed tactics. There were curious gaps in the formation of the living ahead of them. Those gaps had to be where the droid generators of the sonic waves were situated. He began batting blaster fire toward them, and a moment later the pain-inducing shriek was reduced in volume by half. Three blaster bolts later, the sound and pain cut off entirely, and he could hear a mechanical cough as the motivator of the second sonic generator droid detonated dully within its housing.
"Cease fire!"
That was the voice of Thrakken, coming from the rear of the unit of six remaining Corsec operatives. They obeyed.
"Impressive, Jason. But I'd like you to understand, we have more than enough troops, droids, and special surprises to deal with you. They're here or rushing here. You're never going to get anywhere you can do significant harm to this station."
"You may be right, cousin. But you haven't mentioned Ben," Jason thought. "You're not aware of him, are you?"
Above Corellia.
Lysa's sensor board lit up like a festival parade. She glanced at the readings. Someone had a targeting lock on her. She forced herself to ignore that fact. Her leg bounced even more frantically.
"Leader 8.
Eight's voice sounded anguished.
"They have a targeting lock on me. Permission to break and fire."
"Denied, 8.
Vibrosword leader sounded exasperated.
"They're just trying to rattle you, 8.
Lysa said.
"Provoke a reaction."
Now she could see the oncoming attack fighters clearly in the light reflected from Corellia's surface. They glided toward Vibrosword Squadron on what looked like an atmospheric arrival vector, as slow and unconcerned as if there were no interceptor unit in their direct path. She eyeballed their approach. If they didn't vary their angle, they'd pass right through the center of the Eta 5 formation, coming closest to V-Swords 5 and 6. They did vary their angle. One wing pair of attack fighters adjusted, subtly, putting them on a direct intercept path with 5 and 6. Another pair vectored slightly, putting them on a straight course toward the position 7 and 8 would occupy in about 10 seconds.
"Leader, shut up, 8. Stay on 7.
"Clamp down on it, 8,
Lysa said. 5 and 6 would contact their opposite numbers first, she calculated. They were only a few dozen meters apart now.
"This is 5.
Behind the woman's voice, Lysa could hear cockpit impact alarms ringing.
"Impact!
Incoming,
leader said. Lysa snapped her shields on and kicked her maneuvering thrusters to point her nose down toward the planet's surface. Then she fired her main thrusters, putting the full thrust of its twin ion engines into the underbelly of the attack fighter just 3 meters away. Her Eta 5 leapt away from that fighter and its wingmate, hurtling toward the planet's atmosphere.
"Hey!"
She saw 8's green blip belatedly follow.
"Where the rubber? Hey, I'm hit!"
"How bad?"
Now at full thrust, Lysa began a slow loop up from the planet, a maneuver designed to bring her around to the far side of what had been the attack fighter formation.
"No damage. Shield took it. He's not pursuing."
"So why mention it?"
"Yours is a kill."
Lysa's eyebrows rose. She'd expected a thruster blast to do some harm to the fighter, perhaps surprise the pilot and cause him to bank away reflexively, but it must have penetrated the cockpit. She wasn't sure how she felt. "Save up your feelings for later. Save your feelings for home," her father's voice, something he'd said to her 50 times over the years. She decided to listen to him.
"Get ready to do some shooting, 8.
Yes, I'm your wing."
Fiov stepped up to Admiral Kloskin.
"Sir, there's been an incident. One of our starfighter squadrons has rubbed up against one of theirs, and they're fully engaged now. More squadrons from both sides are moving in to join the conflict."
Kloskin nodded.
"Good, good."
"Sir, with all due respect, that's not good. It's not part of our operation goals."
The Sulliston lowered her voice.
"It would be a big help to officer morale if you'd let them know what your revised goals are. Are we going to assault CEC-1? Because as soon as we get to it, its defenders are definitely going to assault us. Are we going to punch back out of system? Are we going to take on the Corellian fleet?"
Kloskin considered her questions. He realized he was curiously without emotion on these matters, but that, at least, would allow him to make decisions logically. No, assaulting the shipyard designated CEC-1 was not part of their operation. Punch back out of the system and go home with their tails between their legs? Unacceptable. That would make this operation a failure. That would make him a failure. Attacking the Corellian fleet seemed to be the best alternative of the ones presented to him, but he had insufficient information about the composition of the enemy fleet. He resented the fact that his alternatives were so few in number. He needed a new idea, a better idea. He wished he could return to his cabin for a while, lie down, and talk to...
Adila, he whispered.
Adila, Viav said. Your wife?
Yes.
Sir, she's been dead for 4 years.
Yes, I know.
Then the answer came. Yes, a rest, some downtime. A planet-side station for some rest and recreation. That's what they needed. He felt energy course within him again.
Which is the fifth inhabited planet here? Talus or Tralus?
The Sullustan's big eyes blinked in surprise, perhaps at the Admiral's sudden strength of tone.
They both are. They orbit a common point in space, so one is fourth sometimes, and the fifth the rest of the time.
Which one is fifth now?
Fiav raised a comlink to her lips, spoke, listened.
Tralus, sir.
Set a course for Tralus. Communicate it to our entire force, but it's not to be implemented yet. Stand by to recall on all non-hyperdrive-equipped starfighters and support vessels, and to issue an optional recall to those with hyperdrives. Who's our best officer for planning city and planetary-scale assaults on short notice? Very short notice.
Fiav blinked again.
I'll find out, sir.
When you find out, put him or her in charge of planning an assault for the occupation of Tralus. I want the best plan we can get in 15 minutes.
Kloskin clamped down on a laugh that was trying to well up within him. Suddenly he felt alive again, in charge of his destiny. This operation would not fail. It would not be his fault. A disc-shaped transport of Corellian design popped into existence ahead of Dodona.
And blow that hunk of junk out of the sky,
Kloskin said. A sensor officer at a station on the lower level shouted,
That's a friendly, sir. Millennium Falcon.
Kloskin glowered over the edge of the walkway at the sensor officer.
So we can't destroy him?
That's, right, sir.
Well, tell him to get that death trap out of the sky. It's dangerous here.
Yes, sir.
What's not dangerous?
Han put as much put-upon aggravation into his tone as he could.
You're here. I'm reading Corellian forces ahead of this orbit and out from your formation. I'm getting reports of dogfights over Coronet. Where do I go? I've got my wife here. How do I keep her safe?
In the Falcon's co-pilot seat, Leia shot her husband an unamused look. Han shot her an apologetic glance.
Solo, you've dropped your civilian vehicle into the middle of a military conflict,
the anonymous voice from Dodona said.
We just recommend you get to safety, now. We don't have time to figure out where it is for you.
I'm plotting an exit course back along your orbital track. I'll use your ships for protection. Tell them not to shoot at me. Falcon out.
Wait!
Han cut his comm board.
Strap in, sweetheart, he said.
Leia did so, grudgingly.
Han, you're playing a dangerous game.
I'm sorry about the whole protect my wife thing. That was just to confuse them.
I don't mean that. I mean joyriding around in the middle of a battle.
I want to see the composition of their forces. I want to see how they conduct themselves when they're assaulting my homeworld. Hold on.
Center Point Station.
Ben lay atop a square-sided conduit a meter wide and tall. It was suspended 5 meters above the passageway floor. Just a meter below the ceiling and immediately below him, Corsec agents were talking. One said,
Any word?
Another, They've got him boxed in at one of the empty theater chambers.
They got him then?
I don't know. He's a Jedi. They're sneaky. Ben grinned. Sneaky. He liked that. His face fell as a realization hit him. He was sneaky, and he was really good at being sneaky. But being sneaky wasn't enough. Sneaky was slow. Skulking, crouching, hiding, crawling. It took forever. He was in the corridor that would take him to the station's repulsor control chamber. By his calculation, it was just a few hundred meters away. but moving stealthily along every centimeter of that distance might take hours, and all because the enemy knew they were facing Jedi. Ben sat up so fast he banged his head on the ceiling above. He rubbed at the point of impact and considered. He didn't have to be a Jedi right now. Clumsy in his haste, he began pulling his boots off, pulling his Jedi robe and all its accoutrements free, and in a minute was left wearing just a black undershirt and black shorts. His lightsaber and all the electronic toys intended to make this mission a success went into his pouch. Pouch in hand, he dropped over the edge to the floor beneath, rolling up to his feet and began running in the direction of his destination.
Above Corellia.
Lysa ended her run along the length of the vibrosword attack fighter engagement. She would let her thrusters put her some distance away from the conflict before turning around for another run. She was certain that she scored some hits on Corellian attack fighters, but it flashed by so fast she had no idea if any were debilitating, if any were kills. Killing Corellians. Eight was still on her tail, but sparks were shooting out and up from his portside thruster.
Seven, I'm hit.
How's it look?
Not good. It's overheating. Venting it to space isn't doing any good.
Shut it down and get back to Dodona.
Will do.
Eight sounded regretful.
You'd better hook up with the V-swords and see if you can pick up a temporary wingmate.
You're right. Then Lysa's eye was caught by something on her sensor board. A lone enemy blip, its course taking it near her position and down toward the planet. After this, she said. She peeled off and looped around to follow in the new starfighter's wake. Her sensor board had it classified now, an X-Wing. As her range fighter indicated that she was at maximum effective range for an interceptor's laser cannons, she swung her targeting brackets toward the X-Wing. But the snub fighter suddenly jerked upward, sideways to port and starboard, always in a direction opposed to her targeting bracket's approach to it. She had the eerie sensation that the pilot knew exactly when she was going to begin aiming. She didn't know whether to curse or smile more broadly. This pilot was good. He jittered in her targeting brackets once, twice, three times, on each occasion long enough for her to pull the laser cannon trigger, but never long enough for the laser blast to find a home in his fuselage. She missed with each shot, sometimes by only a few meters. And suddenly, he was going in reverse. She overshot him, adrenaline jolting through her. It was a classic X-Wing flying technique used against a faster pursuer, and it had been executed at exactly the moment she least expected it. She pushed down on her control yoke, just long enough for her opponent to believe that she was going to dive and loop around. Then she yanked back, coming up and into a portside roll. Her comm board crackled, and its scanner indicated that the broadcast was coming in across a general GA military frequency, but very low-powered, so faint that only she was likely to pick it up.
Nice interceptor rollout. I'd swear you learned that from Tycho Selchu.
Again, Lysa froze. She had learned that maneuver from General Selchu, the celebrated officer who had flown an A-Wing into and out of the second Death Star more than 30 years ago. And she knew the voice of her opponent, even as altered as it was by the low-power transmission and standard comm distortion.
Daddy?
She said.
Hello, sweetheart.
She rolled again, sending her in a steep descent toward the X-Wing. Her vector brought her in toward the X-Wing's topside. She adjusted her course so they were parallel, her E-5 interceptor immediately above the X-Wing. Then she rolled her starfighter over so they cruised canopy to canopy, a mere 4 meters separating them. And she looked up into the face of her father, Wedge Antilles.
Daddy, you're retired. Get out of the skies.
Lysa was suddenly aware of and embarrassed by the adolescent wail in her voice.
I'll do that, sweetheart.
Wedge waved an admonishing finger at her.
Don't get hurt.
I won't, Daddy.
Wedge adjusted his course and was suddenly dropping more steeply away from her. Lysa rolled back up to a more natural orientation, putting the planet beneath her keel, and pulled back on her control yoke, sending her higher. Slowly, she looped around back toward her squadron's last known position.
Center Point Station.
Jason sliced through the midsection of his last opponent's blaster rifle and followed through with a spinning kick that catapulted the man over the walkway rail. With a wail of fright, the man dropped 2 stories distance to the metal floor, an impact that Jason calculated would injure but probably not kill him. Jason turned to look back the few meters he had just come. 8 of the Corsec agents lay on the walkway, unconscious, some bleeding, 2 of them missing their right forearms. 2 sonic projectors installed on the lower bodies of R5 astromechs sat smoking and motionless. The other 4 Corsec agents, and Thrakken Sal Solo,
had retreated through a heavy metal door, about 4 meters high. It looked like original Centerpoint station equipment, though the security pad next to it was of more recent manufacture. Jason could sense danger and malice on the other side of that door. He reached for the open button, not expecting it to work. Doubtless Thraken had locked it down. But a vision of the future, of one possible future, crossed Jason's thoughts, and he jerked his hand back. In his mind's eye, he saw himself depressing the button, an electronic signal passing along the security device's pathways to an odd device on the other side of the door. An explosion powerful enough to blow the door and a large section of wall around it to nothingness. Jason trotted down the walkway, putting a good distance between him and the door, then turned back to focus on the security pad. Barely visible at this distance was the tiny green glow of the open button. He put his hands over his ears and exerted himself against that button. The merest push with the force. The walkway beneath Jason's feet rocked, then quickly steadied itself. He ran back the way he'd come, putting on a force-based burst of running speed and leapt through the new opening in the wall. Ben heard and felt the boom, distant and muffled, originating somewhere well beneath his feet, and was diverted enough to use the force to seek out Jason. Dimly, he could feel his cousin, could sense movement and vitality from him. But the distraction was long enough for Ben to run clean into someone. He banged into rigid body armor, bounced off, and hit the metal floor butt first. He looked up into the face of a Corsec officer glowering down at him.
"Back the way you came, son," the officer said. "This area is under lockdown."
"I've got to see my father," Ben said, swiftly improvising. "He's guarding the repulsor control room. I have to be sure he's all right."
"No, kid, it's off limits."
"I have to know he's all right." Ben made the words a child's frightened wail. He darted around the Corsec officer, eluding the man's grab, and continued running down the corridor. He couldn't keep his shoulders from riding up, tensing. He reached out with the force, searching out the guard's response to his action. Ben felt no intimation of danger. The guard didn't aim his blaster. Ben grinned to himself. That was easy. At a distance of 50 meters, Ben began to make out what guarded the door into the repulsor control chamber. 2 Corsec agents, one male and one female, and a floating ball-shaped droid with 4 arms dangling from it. Even as Ben saw them, the floating droid drifted out from the doorway, its repulsor lift humming into the middle of the corridor as if to bar his passage. 2 of its arms, ending in bulbous pods with barrels, rose to aim at him. Ben raised his own arms and shouted, "Don't shoot! I'm only a kid!" He heard the female guard say, "Hold your fire!" And then she stepped out to beckon Ben forward. He moved toward her at a quick walk.
"I'm lost!"
he wailed.
"Do you have a data pad?" the woman asked. "I can transmit you a map out of here."
"No!"
Ben said.
Now he stood in front of her and the hovering droid. It looked pretty sturdy, and he could see nodules on the top surface that probably indicated deflector shield generators, but he didn't think its shields were up. Even without them, its bronze-colored metal hide suggested that it could withstand a blaster shot or two.
"You stay right here," the woman said. "I'll get a printout of the map."
Her companion, who hadn't budged from in front of the door, finally spoke.
"No," he said. "Protocol is we call it in and they send someone to escort him out of the area."
"There's no one available to escort him," she said. Ben felt his pulse quicken. If the woman agent got her way, she'd be opening the door for him. One last task for him to undertake. Still, he'd have to take her out, and her partner, and the big floating ball in order to get into the room.
"Prioritize your steps," Jason always told him. Priority 1 was the floating droid. Everything began to move in slow motion, as though the entire corridor were suddenly submerged in thick, invisible fluid. Ben saw the door begin to slide upward. Doors like this opened almost instantly, but his time perception was so dilated that he watched it as it rose a meter. He held his hand above his pouch and tugged through the force. His lightsaber leapt up into his hand, and he snapped it on, swinging it at the hovering droid even as the distorted snap hiss noise announced that the blade was coming alive. Instead of slashing, he leapt upward and thrust down, aiming for one of the deflector shield nodules. The point of his lightsaber blade sheared through the bronze hull there, punching into the droid's insides. Ben kept his hands on the lightsaber handle, letting his weight drag the weapon down through the droid. The droid fell almost as fast as he did. With agonizing slowness,
and Ben could see the male guard reacting to the attack, bringing his rifle barrel up. Ben's heels hit the ground, and he continued downward, going into a sideways roll toward the now fully open doorway. The male guard tried to track the boy with his blaster rifle. The woman, her face distorted in surprise, was punching the close button on the security panel. Her identicard was still in the panel's card slot. Ben came up on his feet between the man and the woman so close that the man's blaster barrel now protruded safely past him and lashed out at the control panel. His lightsaber blade slashed into the controls and into the identicard, burning and fusing it into place. The blade came so close to the back of the woman's hand that he saw her skin blacken along a 4-centimeter patch. Her knuckles still hit the close button, even as the near edges of that button melted from the lightsaber's heat. Ben continued his forward roll, going head over heels into dimness, and as the door came slamming down behind him, into darkness, illuminated only by the glowing blue blade of his weapon. He couldn't make out much of the chamber's interior. There was a large mass in front of him, as if someone had parked a small ground speeder on its tail there. It didn't correspond to anything Dr. Sayah had showed him in the simulations. There were little lights in various colors all over the walls. First things first. He spun and lunged back at the door, thrusting with his lightsaber at the top, where the lifter mechanism should be. He shoved the lightsaber blade in well above his head, cutting upward and sideways, trying to sever the mechanism, or failing that, fuse it. This would give him time to accomplish his mission. His mission. That thought almost made him dizzy. It was his mission now. His cutting done, he slapped the light control on the door control panel. White overhead lights came on, and he spun, lightsaber ready, in case enemies waited there in the dark. No living enemies did, but the room was still not as it was supposed to be. The banks of lights, computers, and secondary control tables, some original equipment, and some installed by the Corellians, lined the walls as they had in Dr. Sayah's simulations. But where the main control table was supposed to be, rested something else entirely. It was a mound of machinery as big as half a dozen huts, engaged in a no-rules wrestling match. Roughly human-shaped, it had a desk-sized head that looked like a sensor node, whose surface was thickly crusted with antenna, light monitors, and holocam lenses. Its torso was made up of mismatched modules, each at least as big as the head, connected with durasteel cables and light-bearing transparent steel fibers. Dangling torso units surrounded, perhaps incorporated, the control board Ben needed to access. Fully upright, it would probably be 4 meters tall, but it sat, hunched forward, like a lazy student kneeling with bad posture. Its head turned to bring 2 oversized holocam lenses to bear on him, and it spoke from somewhere in the head unit, its synthesized tone strikingly reminiscent of Jason Solo's voice.
"Who are you?"
"I'm Ben Skywalker," the boy said.
"Wonderful,"
the droid said.
"I'm so happy to meet you. I'm Anakin Solo."
Coronet Corellia.
The Beharry spaceport, though a minor one by the standards of Coronet or any decent-sized city, still sprawled for many acres, even though it was located only a couple of kilometers from the urban heart. Kalir directed Than to a cluster of businesses whose parking area was surrounded by tall trees. As the ground speeder slowed to a stop, Zek's eyes came open, alert, untroubled, unclouded by pain. "Are we on Corellia yet?" he asked.
"Quiet, you," Jaina said. "Than, Kalir, status?"
"Skywalker's squadron is making a run over the government center," Than said, "to disguise the real purpose of their arrival and to give us some time to get airborne. As soon as we are, he'll disengage and come over to escort us into space. Tahiri's speeder will be here in a couple of..." He looked around. "Over there."
Another ground speeder, this one an inconspicuous blue, settled down on the parking pad adjacent to theirs. At the controls was Tahiri Vela, blonde-haired and green-eyed, a few standard years younger than Jaina. She was dressed in a utility worker's gray jumpsuit. Beside her was Doran Tainer. Tall, fair-haired, brown-eyed, square-jawed, and blandly handsome as any holodrama-leading man, but incongruously dressed in brown, grass-stained field workers' garments. Both were Jedi. At the moment, neither looked like it. In the speeder's back seat was something roughly the size of a grown human woman, wrapped in a brown cloak from its calves to the crown of its head. Only feet protruded, clad in brown leather boots. Heart suddenly pounding,
Jaina slid out from under Zek and leapt over to that back seat, even as Doran said,
"It's not what you think."
Jaina whipped the cloak away from the head and shoulders of the body, and revealed the features of a brightly polished silver protocol droid, its photoreceptors dim.
"What's this?"